Thank you very much for coming today.
We're here for the First World War Legacy Series of Royal Air Force Museum Lunchtime Lectures. Very pleased that James Halstead is going to talk to us about air power in Allenby's army, the role of EEF air power in Palestine, 1917-1918. And James is a postgraduate student who did his BA at the University of Kent and his MA with King's College London. He was the undergraduate prize winner for Royal Air Force Museum's academic prizes. James is doing a PhD on the information management systems in the British and Commonwealth armies of the Second World War at the University of Brunel, which you started in October.
Yeah.
Amazing. We won't comment on the fact that better focus more on the RAF than seems to say in the title. And today's paper is taken from his postgraduate thesis on combined arms in Palestine. So if you could all welcome James.
Thank you very much for that intro, Harry. And could I say what a privilege it is to speak here today, given that I've been coming here since I was a lot smaller than I am now, and I did work experience here when I was 16. So, popular discourse about the Palestine campaign during the First World War is often restricted to a few points of interest, even within wider military historical literature. Most people with a working knowledge of the First World War will commonly associate Palestine with T.E. Lawrence. If you're digging a bit deeper, you might start to learn about the Easterner versus the Westerner debate and Palestine's place within that. But if we're talking about air power in Palestine, then ground attack during the Battle of Megiddo is often the limit of wider engagement. Otherwise, there's not really a wider conception of what air power is doing to contribute to the EEF's victory in Palestine. Even within academic literature, there's been some good work done on the campaign, including the air campaign, but there's still a divide between these two campaigns. So the respective official histories by Cyril Falls and H.A. Jones really created this split in the late 1920s, as they're both heavily influenced by the interwar debates between the Army and the Air Force. While there is, of course, a level of synergy between these official histories, neither contextualizes how the Royal Flying Corps and, later, the Royal Air Force assisted the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, or EEF, in achieving its objectives. This trend continues throughout the historiography, but by examining the contribution of air power to the battles of Third Gaza and Megiddo, we can better understand why air power is such an important component of the EEF's victory. I'm going to start off by explaining the military dynamics of the Palestine campaign, which helped to shape and to contextualise air power's role. This is going to involve a wider discussion on the integration of air power into the EEF's command structures, especially following the arrival of Allenby in command. I'm then going to follow two case studies on the battles of Third Gaza and Megiddo. These are really the two dominant military operations in Palestine during Allenby's tenure as commander, and they both demonstrate very different operational dynamics. Third Gaza is a gradual offensive that maintains a consistent tempo to drive back Ottoman forces beyond Jerusalem. For brevity, I'm going to use the term Third Gaza to refer to the full offensive between the end of October and the beginning of December, as is done in several early works on the campaign. Air power during Third Gaza helped to maintain constant situational awareness, especially amongst corps and army headquarters, allowing for speed of action and the maintenance of pressure on Ottoman forces. In contrast, Megiddo is a fast-moving shock action, lasting about a week, although much of a large-scale fighting is over after the first 2 days. While we often focus upon air power's use of ground attack during Megiddo, air power is also vital to coordinating the deep cavalry thrusts. So the two case studies, representing the two main battles of the Palestine campaign between 1917 and 1918, also offer interesting contrasts to one another. If anyone's really desperate to talk about the Transjordan raids of early 1918, then by all means we can discuss that in the questions. But for considerations of time, I've had to limit this paper to Third Gaza and to Megiddo. Before I start off, I want to talk about some of the more specific concepts I'm going to be discussing in this paper. I'm sure that most people are familiar with the structuring of the army headquarters, then corps, then divisions, then brigades, and then individual battalions. Well, we're mostly going to be concerned with a divisional as the lowest level of command, although Cooperation Palestine does mainly rest at the corps level as the very lowest level. One of the first things that Allenby does in Palestine after arriving is to reorganise the EEF along Western front lines into three corps. So we've got 20 Corps, 21 Corps, and a Desert Mounted Corps, or DMC, which is, unsurprisingly, an all-cavalry formation. Air power is also divided along Western front lines into two wings, a corps and an army wing, which are commanded by a newly formed Air Brigade HQ called Palestine Brigade. This is very much a restructuring along Western front lines, with command of air power centred at the Corps and the Army levels. Each Corps should, theoretically, have a squadron from 5 Corps wing at its disposal. They can order this to do anything from contact patrols during an attack, artillery cooperation missions, close reconnaissance, or the dropping of messages to forward troops. But a central part of the role of these aircraft is that they're providing information directly to Corps HQ so that it can keep track of the battle in their sectors. The faster that Corps HQ can receive information, the faster they can act on it, and the better picture they have of a battle. At the Army level, you have a similar arrangement, where Palestine Brigade HQ exists as a constituent element of GHQ and directs 40 Army wing missions to provide GHQ with a wider picture of the battle and to carry out ground attack. All of these missions are generating information, which is essentially pretty useless unless you can get it to the right people. So there are a number of internal structures which get developed to disseminate this information. Corps headquarters will obviously be able to receive this information pretty easily, but there's also the matter of keeping formations on the ground abreast of their position in the wider battle and on the location of neighbouring units, especially once the fighting moves into more difficult or mountainous terrain. Intelligence also needs to be communicated back up to GHQ, so you have a lot of internal structures and intelligence bodies built up essentially to disseminate information and to make sure that all the constituent parts of the EEF maintain situational awareness. So pictured here are the signs that each division and corps have to lay out so that they can be spotted from the air, basically to allow their positions to be marked down on the situation maps at the end of each day, and in case they need to drop messages to the HQs. Palestine's geography and environment also increase the importance of air power to communication and intelligence gathering. While on the Western Front, the main role of Corps wing aircraft is to provide an aerial spotting platform for the artillery, this becomes somewhat negated in Palestine, mainly because of the distances to which advances take place. A lot of the fighting takes place on Palestine's coastal plain, which you can see here, which is obviously very flat. So once the defensive line is breached, the defenders often have to fall back quite a long way to reach the next defensible feature. And a lot of the fighting revolves around dried riverbeds, known as wadis, and higher ground, such as ridgelines or the Judean foothills. Coupled with extremely poor roads, this means that when the EEF advances, they often leave their heavy artillery and logistical tail behind them. They're also advancing into completely unknown and often unmapped territory. So the information provided by air power is vital for helping to keep this advance together. Allenby's reforms of the EEF structure are a big improvement on Murray's tenure in command, where there are several communication difficulties. Allenby takes over at the end of June 1917, and he makes a big difference. There's lots talking about his impact on the morale of the force, but he also makes significant impacts on military effectiveness. As discussed previously, he reorganises the EEF into 3 corps, but he also brings in, or promotes, a lot of officers with Western Front experience, such as Bowles, his former chief of staff from France, Howard Weiss, and Bartholomew. These officers are all given prominent staff roles within the EEF, helping to transfer a lot of relevant experience from France to Palestine. When he takes command of the EEF, Allenby only has 2 air power squadrons on strength, and he's very aware that he needs more to help power this new command structure. He recognises this on July 17, soon after taking command, when he writes to Robertson that, "My aeroplanes are to be made up to 4 squadrons, 2 artillery and 2 fighting. My original demand of 13th of July was that I should have a total of 5 squadrons. However, I am satisfied with a total of 4. Unfortunately, no trained squadrons can be provided for this expansion, partly because of the anticipated need to be sent to Italy. And although some machines are sent over from England, Allenby mostly has to improvise. Luckily, there's a pilot training school in Egypt, so brand new squadrons can be formed in theatre and equipped with a mishmash of different equipment sent over from England or repaired by the in-theatre ex-aircraft park. These new squadrons are 111 and 113 squadron. 111 is only formed in September 1917, so they're both pretty raw formations, even by the time the offensive starts in late October. Because the rest of the EEF is reorganising throughout August, Air Power isn't reformed into the Air Brigade structure with the Army and the Corps Wing until September, when 3rd Gaza was meant to take place. This lack of air power is certainly a factor in the delaying of 3rd Gaza, but we need to be careful not to over-egg this. But given that one squadron is still in the process of forming, even in September, and that Allenby was insistent that he have at least 4 squadrons for the battle, it's likely air power is one of the factors contributing to the delayed start of the Battle of 3rd Gaza. Alongside these command structures, the EEF developed a number of complex systems for disseminating information around the command structure in an efficient manner. We can split these into 2 distinct systems. The first transmits orders down to individual squadrons. This is essentially the Corps and Army Wing system I explained earlier. Each Corps controls a squadron from 5 Corps Wing, to which they can allocate missions up to 10,000 yards from the most advanced troops. EEF GEHQ controls 40 Army Wing, Free Palestine Brigade HQ, to which they allocate wider missions across the entire front. All of these missions collect information, and as well as communicating these to the relevant HQs, this information is also collected and disseminated across the full EEF, down to battalion level in some cases. That's where the second system comes in, and where it gets slightly confusing, because we have Palestine Brigade split into 2 different battle groups. These battle groups are based around their geographical aerodrome location, which means each battle group exists outside the conventional command structure and contains a mixture of squadrons from 5 and 40 wing. This is obviously the most efficient way to achieve this, because they can just land at the aerodrome, hand the information over to their liaison officer, who then sends this back up to Palestine Brigade. So we've essentially got 2 completely different systems. One is for transferring orders down the command chain and is based around conventional command structures based at Corps and Army level. And the other is a geographically organised one to collect and disseminate information back up the command chain, but they both rely on fairly different structures. Air Power helps create situational awareness during the advance by providing aerial photography and for mapping the terrain ahead of EEF. Aerial photography provides daily situation maps for commanders and rough maps for troops. There are very few accurate maps available for Palestine, and both sides often had to rely on poor quality maps. Ottoman forces relied on commercial pilgrim maps for much of the campaign. The EEF, however, were able to make more accurate maps as they advanced with the aid of aerial photography and an efficient dissemination system. New maps of the territory being advanced into were regularly compiled from aerial photography, and officers down to at least company level were provided 1 to 40,000 scale maps in this way. Daily situation maps were provided to, divisional level and above, since photographic intelligence was plotted onto a master map by a team of staff officers at 40 Wing HQ, with the results immediately carried out to individual formations via dispatch riders. This was greatly aided by the assistance of a photography unit that could make quick copies of these larger maps. It's been estimated that individual commanders could receive updated maps within 5 to 6 hours of the original photographs being taken. While that's hardly iCloud, it's very impressive for 1917, when you're essentially flying 20 to 30 miles, taking the photos, developing the photos, analysing the photos, plotting the information onto the master map, copying the master map, and then getting these updated situation maps out to units that are in the field, often several miles away. It's certainly an indicator of the efficiency of EEF information structures during 3rd Gaza that this could be managed. There are therefore a number of very efficient structures put in place before the 3rd Battle of Gaza to allow for efficient exercise of command by the EEF. I'm going to briefly run through a quick narrative of battle, and we can look at some more specific examples of where those features I've spoken about come into play. We're also briefly going to cover ground attack by RFC aircraft during the battle, because it gives some insight into how the EEF's air power is interacting with enemy command systems. The basic structure of the 3rd Battle of Gaza essentially consists of what Wavell refers to as a crescendo of blows on either end of the Ottoman defensive position between Gaza and Beersheba. The concept of tempo is key here. In a military sense, at its basic level, Tempo is the ability to carry out an action in a faster time than your opponent. It's dependent on several factors like logistics, planning, but especially the ability to move information quickly around a command structure, allowing individual units to have enough information to act. It is vital during Third Gaza. There is no huge breakthrough battle that shatters the Ottoman line, like at Megiddo. And Third Gaza is a matter of gradual pressure, stretching Ottoman reserves and then forcing the whole line back. The systems that I've been describing are absolutely vital for creating the efficiency of information and, therefore, the speed of action, which allows this pressure to be exerted across the Ottoman line. So a basic run-through of the battle is you've got the Beersheba battle on the 31st of October. Then there's an attack at Gaza by 21 Corps. And this really achieves the objective of stretching Ottoman reserves. So they're going to either flank, either to cover Gaza or to counterattack at Beersheba. But by the 6th of November, they break through at Tel Esh-Sharia, and the whole Ottoman line sort of has to fall back to Junction Station. Successive assaults on either flank were designed to keep Ottoman forces off balance, particularly because they only had enough rail transport to move ammunition reserves to either end of a line. Beersheba was captured on 30th October, and it's a battle in which aerial intelligence plays quite a minor role in the success of a battle. As the fabled Australian cavalry charge, which succeeds in capturing the town at sunset, is given much greater confidence by aerial photography before the battle, which demonstrates a lack of wire protecting Beersheba's defences. Aerial intelligence also makes its impact felt on the infantry assault, and one grateful infantry CEO writes to Palestine Brigade that shortly before the Beersheba operations, he received an aspect photo of the defences which caused them to change his dispositions, saving him over 200 casualties. Beersheba isn't as decisive an action as some historians have portrayed it, however, and it's really only the first stage of an operation designed to lever the entire Gaza-Beersheba line loose. 21 Corps attacks at Gaza on the 2nd of November, and although this attack does make some progress, mainly along the beach, Gaza remains in Ottoman hands. This is the heaviest artillery concentration outside of the Western Front during the First World War up to this point, and you can really see the influence of Western Front techniques being felt. There's an officer is sent over from the Western Front before, and he does teach 14 Squadron a lot of the lessons they've learned during the Battle of the Somme the previous summer. And the 14 Squadron, who currently carry out 35 flying hours, and they're able to cool down artillery bombardments on Ottoman reserves forming up to counterattack. There is a bit of a contradiction in that it's one of the most experienced squadrons essentially being assigned to supporting this diversionary attack, while the almost brand new squadron is supporting the sort of the key part of the battle at Beersheba. But to me, that really just shows how much more technically demanding something like artillery cooperation was, and why the EEF is able to get away with pushing these brand new squadrons, two brand new squadrons, into a large battle like Third Gaza, in that there's simply not the same rate of attrition or danger. In the early days of November, there's the fierce fighting in the hills north of Beersheba as an Ottoman counteroffensive attempts to contain the EEF penetration of the Gaza-Beersheba line. This is partly because they're worried that the plan is to drive up to Jerusalem via Hebron, which they aren't planning, but the Ottomans don't know that. So it's a really big Ottoman counterattack to try and at least force them back to Beersheba or contain them, if not capture Beersheba. Air power is especially important here in keeping 20 Corps HQ abreast of the situation on the ground. It does a lot in monitoring location of individual formations. This is the sort of job that air power can carry out in 30 minutes to an hour, but it would take more conventional ground-based techniques several hours or more. There are certainly some limits, and air observation certainly isn't infallible, but it's a much faster and efficient way of maintaining situation awareness at Corps HQ. Once 20 Corps breaks through at Sharia on 6 November, it's essentially a steady retreat to Jerusalem for the Ottomans. There's a pursuit phase until later November, when there are several attempts to reform a defensive line, but the EEF is able to apply a fairly relentless pressure that never gives Ottoman forces an opportunity to dig in. EEF forces are able to move up to the second Ottoman line and break it within several days, capturing the linchpin of Ottoman supply in southern Palestine, Junction Station. This advance is even more impressive when you consider that EEF forces are making maps of the terrain from the air as they advance, but they've outstripped their artillery, and that they're still able to coordinate an outflanking movement and break the second position within days of breaking the first. This advance is, of course, helped by constant aerial surveillance, and during this period especially, reconnaissance orders, as well as reconnaissance reports, as well as orders, are being dropped directly to forward troops. Once Junction Station is captured, the two Ottoman armies fall back either further north or to cover Jerusalem. There's a short lull while the EEF sorts out logistics, then the final phase of the campaign is a drive on Jerusalem itself through the Judean foothills, which I'll talk about after ground attack by the RFC during this pursuit phase. Especially from 7 to 14 November, after Sharia breakthrough, Ottoman forces are heavily harassed from the air by bombing raids, where cooperation with EEF troops helps to maintain the EEF situational awareness. Constant bombardment from the air is both demoralising and breaks down Ottoman commander communications, making it more difficult for commanders to impose their will on the battle. This bombing increases in intensity throughout November as Ottoman troops retreat from the Gazi-Beersheba line. Von Kressenstein, the German commander of the Ottoman 8th Army, even states that these air raids did more to break the heart of the 8th Army than all the hard fighting that had gone before. As well as disrupting their communications, these bombing missions also negate German air support by bombing them out of their aerodromes. It's debated how much material damage these raids actually managed to do, but they certainly significantly disorganise the German air units in Palestine, which means the EEF essentially has air supremacy until Jerusalem. Command and control of ground attack also evolves over the course of the battle, as well as increasing in intensity, as you can see from the chart. B Squadron is a separate bombing squad formation formed before the battle. It's actually only one flight, it's not a squadron. And is made up of training school students from Egypt, equipped with spare BUT machines and assigned to bombing missions. This is another sign of the differences between Palestine and France. In France, equipping newly trained students with outdated machines and telling them to carry out low-flying bombing missions on enemy troops would be suicide. But in Palestine, it's a success. At the beginning of the battle, B Squadron is attached directly to HQ Palestine Brigade, before being seconded to 20 Corps on November 6 for a few days during the Sharia attack. After this, the formation is informally attached to 40 Wings Command until 17 November, when a transfer is formalised. After this, 40 Wing directs all ground attack missions. We can therefore see both the centralisation of ground attack under 40 Wing and also the increase in the quantity of munitions that Palestine Brigade is dropping through November and into December. Once Junction Station is captured, the Ottoman line is essentially split and either falls back onto Jaffa or to Jerusalem. The EEF focuses on capturing Jerusalem, which requires a drive through the Judean foothills. This name is quite deceiving, as they're far from foothills. It's actually very difficult, mountainous terrain. It's a very slow drive. There's an attempt to gut Jerusalem off from the north at first, but this fails, and there's more fighting centred around the Nebi Samuel, which is just to the west of Jerusalem, before 20 Corps takes over the offensive from an exhausted 21 Corps. There's the final envelopment of Jerusalem, with the 53rd Division moving up from Beersheba in the south over several days, while 20 Corps attacks in the west and finally forces Ottoman troops to abandon the city. This sort of slow, attritional warfare in the Judean foothills rather limits the use of combined arms systems, because the nature of the fighting itself almost completely limits dynamism and manoeuvre. What the Royal Flying Corps does continue to do, however, is to improve the links between corps and divisional headquarters. There's also an increase in horizontal links between divisions. By this, I mean that not only are the Royal Flying Corps moving information up from divisional to corps HQ, they're also moving information between neighbouring divisions. There's also an increase in its artillery spotting missions as they move into the foothills, although the mountainous terrain does limit its utility, but it's really as the heavy artillery catches up, especially in a lull during the battle after the capture of Junction Station. So during the Judean foothills, we're essentially seeing the RFC change and adapt to the situation. It can still provide useful information and intelligence links between formations, and, ironically, ends up providing more of this information. RFC reconnaissance reports often double in length and include a great deal more information. but they're just not able to offer the EEF in the Judean foothills as much flexibility as they did before. It is worth pointing out, however, that the 53rd Division, moving up from the south as part of a detachment with several cavalry units, does really benefit from the air power, which monitors their position, passes messages from Corps HQ, and is able to carry out special reconnaissance missions directed by the 53rd Division. This element of the Jerusalem operation is often forgotten, but it's worth pointing out how important air power is to coordinating this drive on Jerusalem. Separated from the rest of the EEF by the foothills, they're very isolated and not part of a continuous front. The final capture of Jerusalem is partly a result of the pressure that 53rd Division places on a city from the south in conjunction with the capturing of Jerusalem's western defences by 20 Corps. This really sums up EEF operational techniques during 3rd Gaza. While one attack is bogged down in the foothills, they're already moving another force in from another direction and coordinating this thrust using air power. Air power, therefore, provides EEF operations during 3rd Gaza with a great deal of dynamism and flexibility. There are a number of other factors which certainly contribute to victory. Training, reinforcements, the opportunity to reform the EEF after 2nd Gaza, and a good plan carried out by a good commander all contribute to victory. I've not even touched on some elements of the air campaign, such as deception operations. But to look at the level at which the systems of the EEF work together to deliver victory, we can see the importance of air power. It maintains a link between Army and Corps headquarters and allows the Corps level of command to control and to monitor the ground battle. In an important step, we see the systems coordinating ground attack develop. Air power therefore helps maintain a steady momentum which levers Ottoman forces out of the defence and doesn't stop until it captures Jerusalem. Moreover, this is all supported by a hastily expanded air force, including two brand new squadrons equipped with a patchwork of equipment. So what I'm going to talk about now is the Battle of Megiddo, which is about a year later in September 1918, and how the RAF was able to successfully support operations which had a very different dynamic to those of 3rd Gaza. Megiddo was a fast-moving shock action by cavalry, which looks a lot like the sort of manoeuvre warfare propagated during the interwar years, and is very different from the more slow and steady Gaza offensive. During March and April 1918, many of the EEF's most experienced formations are moved to France as a result of the German spring offensive. The main impact is on training at battalion level, as largely undertrained Indian battalions are substituted into the wider structures. So this reorganisation doesn't greatly impact on the systems and the structures of the EEF. No divisional or corps HQs are moved to France. Moreover, throughout 1918, there was an expansion of the intelligence structures within the EEF, with corps-level intelligence sections introduced over the summer. Corps intelligence staff are given responsibility for processing intelligence in their individual corps sectors, and corps intelligence officers also brief and debrief 5 corps wing pilots. There are a number of training programs for staff officers implemented, and, in some cases, it looks like training on photographic interpretation went down to staff officers at divisional as well as at corps level. Practical cooperation methods remained much the same during Megiddo as for 3rd Gaza, albeit with some tweaks to the system. Each corps retained control of individual squadrons from 5 wing, and, indeed, each corps now had a full squadron, as opposed to 3rd Gaza, where the DMC and 20 corps had to make do of sharing one. Palestine Brigade is also in a much better situation in September 1918 than in October 1917. The brigade has almost doubled in size with the formation of several new squadrons and an influx of up-to-date equipment from England. No squadron has more than one type of aircraft on strength, apart from one AFC, which had one Handley bomber on strength. All of the 5 wing corps squadrons are upgraded to DH-9s, or 40 Army Wing is equipped with SE-5As and Bristol Fighters. Several Nieuport single-seaters are also provided to Corps aircraft squadrons and provide express reconnaissance services, where they're able to fly back mid-mission to report on specific opportunities. I haven't been able to find out more about these, but several fairly trustworthy sources do talk about them, but there's not much of a not much evidence that this happened in the war diaries, especially in comparison to their German opponents, who only decrease in quality and quantity over the course of 1918. Palestine brigades in a far superior position in September 1918, with both a large numerical advantage and the most advanced planes then in use on the Western Front. Before Megiddo, Allenby meets with his subordinate commanders to advise them on his plan, then conducts another, smaller meeting with just RAF officers, during which they're able to advise on specific cooperation arrangements. From these discussions, we get several outcomes. In air-ground cooperation, the main difference from 3rd Gaza is in the specialised support offered to the Desert Mounted Corps. 142 Squadron is responsible for this, and the Desert Mounted Corps HQ is also accompanied by specialist RAF liaison units. This is led by a liaison officer, Colonel Primrose, who communicates intelligence back to Palestine Brigade HQ and who directs and advises cavalry commanders on aerial reconnaissance. During the advance, air power helps to devolve initiative lower down the command chain by routinely dropping reconnaissance supports to divisional as well as DMC HQ. These methods appear to have been very successful, judging that following the conclusion of operations at Megiddo, Major General Hodgson of the Australian Mounted Division wrote that, "We were able to move forward fast and with confidence, chiefly owing to the fact that all bodies of the enemy had been accurately located by the RAF. They're also able to move information directly from DMC HQ to their subordinate formations through what is described as a picking up apparatus. It's essentially two long poles with a bit of wire between them, which is then stretched out with a message bag attached in the middle of the wire, and the aircraft then flies really low with a hook suspended beneath and picks up the bag, carries it forwards and drops it to the right formation. There's also robust arrangements put in place for coordinating ground attack against Ottoman units. Before the battle, there's a lot of mapping of the ground behind Ottoman lines, which helps EEF GHQ's planning, but it's also very useful for the RAF when they're planning their ground attack missions. RAF planners are able to identify several choke points that Ottoman troops will have to retreat through once the battle begins. During the battle, these choke points are patrolled by Australian Flying Corps Bristol fighters, equipped with wireless machines. When retreating, Ottoman troops are sighted. These aircraft message back to Palestine Brigade, who in turn direct sequenced waves of low-flying ground attack aircraft against them. Often wider studies on the Battle of Megiddo present the calling in of waves of fighter aircraft as an opportunistic and dynamic command system in the air. It's not. It's really down to some very meticulous planning on the part of the RAF that they're able to achieve this effect. Similarly to 3rd Gaza, there are some very thorough procedures put in place for the dissemination of aerial photography. And balloons are also used to help observe for attacks and communicate this information back to Corps headquarters. But due to the speed of the advance, these arrangements swiftly become fairly obsolete. The basic plan for the Battle of Megiddo is for 21 Corps to break the Ottoman lines on the coastal plain, then wheel right and roll up Turkish line, while the DMC rush through the gap and cut their communications. Meanwhile, 20 Corps drive slowly forwards on Nablus, cutting off the Jordan crossings and generally pressuring Ottoman troops. As with 3rd Gaza, artillery observation is an important feature of the fighting at the outset of operations, but it diminishes in quantity and importance once the line is broken. Megiddo is a fast, high-tempo battle, so the two most important roles for air power are in the provision of fast and accurate intelligence to forward formations and in a disruption of Ottoman command structures and cohesion through bombing. The battle starts overnight between 18 and 19 September when the RAF bombs Ottoman communication centres and HQs at Nablus and Al Afiul. Just before dawn, 21 Corps attacks and breaks through by midday. As a testament to the scale of the Ottoman collapse and the ambition of the plan, Shi's 60th Division has to march 16 miles over the course of the first day to take Tul Kaam. There are some reports that distinguished general Bet Shi, his men would not reach Tul Kaam by dark. Happily for she, he's in the headquarters of the Ottoman 8th Army at 5 minutes to 5. Throughout this first day, there are a high number of contact patrol and artillery missions, as per normal for the first day of any attack. As described during the 3rd Gaza section, this really helps to keep the advance together and to maintain situational awareness for corps commanders. After the first day, though, these missions drop off in quantity significantly, and the missions that are happening really don't yield much information. Even though, you know, we can see in the war dives that they are happening, but once you look at the individual mission reports, they're just kind of saying, oh, we saw a few Ottoman troops and we strafed them a bit. A lot of the corps machines are essentially just taking part in opportunistic ground attack, even if they're ostensibly on the artillery or reconnaissance missions, so there really isn't the quantity of work. Throughout the first day and night of the battle, the DMC drives deep into the Ottoman rear, rushes through the Musmas Pass, and are in a position where they're able to surprise von Sanders, the German commander of Ottoman forces, at Nazareth, early in the morning of 20 September. At several points in the advance, they detach troops in response to reports from the air. For example, about 10,000 Ottoman troops are captured after aerial reconnaissance detects, then strafes, a column retreating on Jenin. Similarly, during the drive up the coast, aircraft are able to warn cavalry about concealed Ottoman positions before they arrive, so they're able to capture them quickly. In many cases, however, Ottoman troops simply surrender as they're so demoralised. Ottoman troops are bombed heavily throughout the first few days during their retreat from Tul Kham and at Nablus, and as they retreat towards Jenin in the evening, where that particular column surrenders to the cavalry. The bombing of the Wadi al-Farah on the second day of the battle is one of the more infamous parts of Megiddo, but still just one of several bombings that took place during the battle. Aerial bombardment is a central part of the RAF's success at Megiddo, and they end up dropping over 3 times the tonnage of explosives dropped throughout the entire period of November to December 1917, in just 6 days. Particularly efficient is the neutering of Ottoman command and control networks at the battle's outset. So lastly, I want to talk about Megiddo in the context of certain unique innovations made in the Palestine theatre. We've already seen a transfer of Western Front techniques over to Palestine for the Third Battle of Gaza. Out of the two battles, this is much closer to the Western Front, although it's still quite a fair way out. By Megiddo, there have been more evolutions from the Western Front. The adoption of the corps-level intelligence and topographical sections is one of these. But we also see a lot of divergences from the Western Front. In technology, we see the widespread use of picking up apparatus, especially during operations in mountainous terrain. There's also an airborne smoke screen that's trialled during Megiddo. Salmond actually writes to Sykes, the head of the Air Ministry at the time, offering them for the Western Front. Less successful in inter-theatre dissemination is a homemade and aeroplane-mounted grenade launcher invented and used by a pilot of the Australian Flying Corps. The air-ground liaison system does also take hints from the Western Front, but the devolution and initiative and specialist cavalry liaison units is a theatre-specific development. While it's very much aligned with wider British principles at the time, of the man on the spot being best placed to make a decision, the system for identifying the best targets for ground attack through the patrols of the Bristol Fighters of the Australian Flying Corps owe a lot to the Central Information Bureau system on the Western Front, but it's really been adapted into the source of battle that they're fighting at Megiddo. EEF Air Power in Palestine, therefore, developed a number of efficient techniques to participate in and support the campaigns for the last months of 1917 and across 1918. Air Power was capable of supporting both a lumbering, tempo-intense grind to Jerusalem during Third Gaza and fast-moving shock actions during the Battle of Megiddo. Air Power in Palestine is embedded within the command structure of the EEF, enabling the efficient exercise of command and the collection and dissemination of intelligence throughout the fighting in Palestine. Allenby's air power is therefore a vital and often disregarded cornerstone of EEF victory in Palestine. Thank you.